Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
So we'll start this off right. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mattsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site, and you can find us on social media and on the web. Just search for Dog Works Radio, and DogWorksRadio.com is where all of our shows reside. And calling in from Southern California, our co-host for Mushing Radio, Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. Very happy to be here with you again.
Likewise, Alex. I'm glad that we are back. We're going to talk about the volunteers on the Iditarod today. But before we do, I have a public service announcement for a local dog mushing club here in Alaska. Chugiak Dog Mushers Association will be conducting two dryland clinics free to the public to learn how to train and race your dogs. The instructors will share dryland training techniques, how to run or pull a bike, scooter, or rig with your dogs. The class will cover the essentials to get you started in training or racing with your sled dogs. Dog safety, equipment needs, techniques, trails, and race rules will be explored. Please do not bring any dogs. The first class clinic will be held at REI in Anchorage on September 3rd from 6 to 7:30, and participants may enroll on the REI website. I'll make sure I post that on our show page. The second classroom clinic will be held at Alaska Mill and Feed on 9/12/15 from 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. No registration is necessary for this clinic. The Chugiak Dog Mushers Association are going to have their second annual dryland race series. It's going to start on 9/12 and also on 10/3 and 4. It's a $2,000 purse for that, and it's a lot of fun. We did it last year with several of our teams. We ran on the carts as well as with the bike tour races. We plan to be back this year, and we're looking forward to it. For more information, check out ChugiakDogMushers.com. That is C-H-U-G-I-A-K, DogMushers.com. All right, Alex, let's jump right into this. We're talking about the volunteers for the mushers and the race on the Iditarod. Is that right?
That is correct. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about volunteers on many past shows, and the truth of the matter is now and has always been that the Iditarod simply could not exist without the volunteers. There are so many people who come up to Alaska from all over the United States and literally all over the world, as well as a large group of people who are already in Alaska who volunteer every year. And I have heard stories from people about long-term friendships, people who have been coming up together and working together as volunteers for 10, 15, and 20 years. There are a number of mushers who started as volunteers and then caught the bug and decided that this is what they wanted to do as well, including Karin Hendrickson and Mike Supernaut and a bunch of other folks who worked first as volunteers for the race before they really started mushing themselves seriously. And when we talk about volunteers, it's a little bit hard to pin down the exact number of volunteers who help out each year in the race, but it is definitely in the hundreds and possibly over 1,000. And these are people who make their own way to Anchorage and other places, and come on their own dime because they love being around the Iditarod. They love the idea of dog-powered sports, and they just really want to be a part of this. So starting from right before the race, there is a lot of stuff that has to go on in preparing for the race. The ceremony will start in Anchorage. They block off streets and people put up fencing, and then people bring in snow that is put on the streets and then smoothed down over the streets so that they can run the first 11 miles in the city of Anchorage. In addition to that, there are volunteers who do dog handling, and a lot of the mushers who are more local will have their own dog handlers they will bring to the race. But mushers, particularly who come from a long way away, often do not have a full complement of dog handlers that they will need at the start. And so the people who come in to volunteer for Iditarod are assigned that job. And I know that you have been a race day dog handler for Hugh Neff a couple of times in his Iditarod runs.
Right. Yeah, that is one of the most fun experiences in the world. You're down there in the chaos of everything that happens with the Iditarod start, and we've talked about it many times on this show. There's definitely a circus atmosphere down there, and as a handler, you show up pretty early in the morning, and you make sure all the gear is set up for those mushers, and you get ready to go, and you run maybe up to a half a mile down the snow-covered streets of Anchorage to get your musher started. But did you know, Alex, that just in the last couple of years, they have a volunteer handler's course that a lot of these folks have to go through. If they're going to be working with Iditarod, they have to take a handler's through the ITC in order to be able to handle those dogs down there on the streets of Anchorage.
Yeah, which is a very good thing, because you, as someone who's been working with dogs for many, many years, are very familiar with how dogs act and how you can prepare them and get them in harness. But that all changes when you're in an atmosphere like the start or the restart, when there are often over 1,000 dogs in a very close, in very close proximity. So you have to not only know about dog psychology, you have to know about what the particular needs of racing dogs are, and then you have to know how to handle being in that situation in such a crowded condition. You know, because a lot of times, even with some of the smaller races, dogs are not used to being around that many dogs at one time. And certainly when you're training, you know, there maybe are 20 or 40 dogs, and if you pass another team or another few teams, maybe you'd encounter 100 dogs at a time. But this is a lot more than that, and has its own special requirements and special needs. So it's a very good thing that they are doing that now.
Alex, I think we should mention that that this whole process really starts in June, doesn't it? At the volunteers' picnic. I know that. That's really when Iditarod season kicks off, and it's becoming almost a year-round event, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've talked several times about the Iditarod Trail Committee, which is a relatively small organization in terms of the number of people who work for it and are paid to work for it. In addition to that small number, there are many, many year-round volunteers who do things like making sure that the website is kept running, making sure that information goes out to mushers. There are a lot of sort of more clerical and organizational things that go on year-round. But once it gets to Iditarod season, there are a lot of things that happen, and everyone starts coming into Anchorage. The Lakefront Hotel, which used to be the Millennium Hotel, is the race headquarters. And starting, I believe, about 10 days or 2 weeks before the start of Iditarod, they open up the volunteer center there. And volunteers who are coming in have to come and check in. And usually ahead of time, they have been assigned the various tasks that they're going to do. And there's a lot of very interesting tasks, and there are some that used to be a much bigger deal that have become a lot less important. There is a room in the hotel, which is the phone room for the race. And it used to be, 5 or 10 years ago, that this was the central place where information came out of. And people would call into the phone room at all hours of day and night, and it was always staffed, and they would get information about what the standings were, when people had left particular checkpoints, and there was a lot of stuff always going on in the phone room. That has, to a large extent, moved onto the internet, and there is just a lot more information available 24 hours a day on the Iditarod website and through Iditarod Insider and all of that. But nonetheless, the phone room is still a very important part of Iditarod. And it's a very interesting place to be, particularly in the middle of the night, because that is when people will call in from different parts of the world, and people who aren't quite always clear on what the Iditarod is or how it works. And so the volunteers who work in the phone room always have to be very friendly, very patient, and able to answer a lot of different questions.
And, it's not much bigger than a hotel room, is it? I know I went in there a couple of years ago and saw all that activity, and it's a relatively small room. It's not something that you would think about with having a bank of phones and, people running around. It's a relatively small space to take care of all that business.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, in the Lakefront Hotel, they have a gigantic sort of status board of all of the racers, and all throughout the race that's updated, and with the times that they come in and out of various checkpoints, how many dogs they come in with, how many dogs they go out with. So that's something that happens there as well. That hotel is also the site of the Anchorage dog drop. So when dogs are dropped on the trail, they are most of the time brought back to Anchorage, and they are kept behind the hotel by the lake so until either the musher's representative, one of their handlers, can come and pick them up, or if they're not picked up by the end of the day, they're brought to a minimum security prison right outside of Anchorage, where the inmates will care for the dogs until the musher's people can come and get them. And being one of the dog drop volunteers is considered a very coveted job, because you get to interact with the dogs. And almost everyone who volunteers for Iditarod does so because they have a really deep love of the dog. So this is an opportunity to get your dog time in.
Right. And once the race begins in Anchorage, the ceremonial start, this volunteer process really kicks into gear. And I want to make sure that we have time to cover all this, Alex, but we've talked about it many times on the show, that the mass of Iditarod workers, the volunteers and everybody that's taking part in this race often hopscotch down the trail, going from one checkpoint to another. So there's several people moving at all times, aren't there?
Right. And being a volunteer who goes up and down the trail is a coveted position, and people generally are not able to do that immediately. So that's something that people who have been volunteering for several years usually get to do. And we've talked about the Iditarod Air Force, which also is all volunteers. But the people who are hopscotching up and down the trail, the volunteers will go with the Iditarod Air Force. So they're going in these very small planes with often three or four or five people going from checkpoint to checkpoint. And of course, people who have been listening for a while or people who are familiar with the race know that once you get past Willow, which is where the restart is, none of this is on the road system. So in order to get from checkpoint to checkpoint, really the only option is to fly.
You had mentioned, Alex, that most people have done this for several years. And you know, I've met volunteers of all ages, from 18 to 80, that are out there doing all sorts of jobs. So it's just amazing how much camaraderie and experience a lot of these folks have. Many people, this is their vacation of the year. They save up for it. They plan for it. Their whole year revolves around volunteering for the Iditarod, doesn't it?
Yeah, and what you just mentioned is one of the most important things that I wanted to convey about the volunteer experience, is that these people are generally incredibly enthusiastic and friendly, and you will get, particularly at the start and the restart, where there are a lot of volunteers and they have a lot of different tasks that have to be done, and people are just thrown at the tasks in small groups and have to figure things out and have to organize things. You always find that these people, many of whom haven't met each other before and don't really know each other, just instantly fall into a camaraderie and a working relationship that is very effective and very, very friendly. You know, I'm not saying that nobody ever has a bad day, but some of the happiest and most content people I've ever met are people who are...
Are you with us, Alex?
I am. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We'll do some editing before we go. You were
okay.
Talking about the camaraderie on the trail. Let's pick it up from there.
Yeah. So people who have never met each other will just instantly fall into a great working relationship. And among the happiest people I've ever seen are people who are volunteering for Iditarod. And I was saying, and I think this was after it got dropped, that the first time I was up at Iditarod, there was a volunteer who was working as a dog handler at the restart. And she was asking very, very pointed and specific questions of the musher. And one of the other mushers came over, and the two mushers were listening to this woman ask questions and talk about the dogs. And they exchanged this look. And it wasn't clear to me at the time what the look meant, but I know now that what the look meant was, here's someone else who has the bug. This handler is clearly somebody who is going to be running dogs and competing in races within a couple of years. And in fact, that was the case.
Can you tell us the name of that person? Do you know?
You know, I don't remember the name of that person, but I imagine that this is not an uncommon story, because I know that a lot of people who start as volunteers then will go for sled rides, will be talking to the mushers, and then will come up and get jobs as handlers and learn more and more about running dogs. And so that's just a wonderful way to always be bringing people into the sport.
And you know, Alex, speaking of the bug, last year, I guess it was this year's Iditarod Teacher on the Trail has also caught the bug. And she plans to start mushing dogs, doing her qualifiers, I believe, this winter, and hopes to run Iditarod in 2017. So that's also a very common occurrence for these teachers on the trail to catch that bug. And the next thing you know, they're on the Iditarod Trail themselves.
Yeah, and it's always a wonderful thing to me when someone who already is interested in the sport gets a closer look at it and appreciates and loves it all that much more, and then goes on to compete.
Well, you know, Alex, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, but you've been an avid fan for years. When are we going to see you sign up for Iditarod?
I think I have a few qualifiers to do first. And,
maybe
and I've got to get some dogs.
Maybe. All right. So carrying on, we've talked about the start and the restart, and we've also talked about the mushers that are on the trail, and there's myriad positions out there. There's communications positions, teachings. We've talked about the volunteer veterinarians. We've talked about those folks that are helping run the checkpoints. There's all things going on these 24-hour shifts at all of these checkpoints on down the trail. Are you familiar, Alex, with how a person is placed in a particular position? Is it first come, first serve? Is it seniority? Is it the qualifications? Because I ask that is many times these folks are from all over the world, and often you'll see on their name badge, you know, Mrs. Smith is from Tampa, Florida, or whatever. So folks do not necessarily have a heck of a lot of experience when they're jumping into these positions.
Right. The trail positions tend to be people who have been volunteers before. So those are a little bit by seniority. There's also there are also certain positions that require different types of qualifications. The comms positions or the communications are often very, very detail-oriented jobs. So they want people who have experience with things like logistics and scheduling, because there's a lot of coordinating information that is coming from the various checkpoints, as well as trying to make sure that all of the race officials and all of the veterinarians and all of the other volunteers who are moving up and down the trail have planes from the Iditarod Air Force that can take them up and down the trail. So scheduling and coordinating that can be very tricky. And there's a tendency that those type of positions are usually done by the same group of people year in, year out. There is some new people who come in, but the core of the comms group is usually the same from year to year. And then there are other positions, other volunteer positions, such as the trail sweeps, who are the people who come at the end when all of the mushers have gone through on snow machines, and there are trail breakers who will go out in front of the leaders to make sure that the trail is relatively cleared and that it is to the best extent possible well marked and you know, to prevent people from going too far off the trail or not being able to tell where the trail is.
And what's interesting about the Iditarod, for folks that are fans, of course, they know it's almost 1,000 miles over a vast amount of terrain. Much of that terrain is not accessible by road system, and at some particular point, all of this switches over from Anchorage to Nome, in particular dog drops and where people are flying in and out of, and gear and supplies is moving in one direction or the other, and that happens as the race progresses, and everything switches gears from Anchorage, you know, on this side of the race, over to Nome, and of course, everybody travels, I guess that would be west versus southeast, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the side effects of switching over is that it is just because of where Nome is and the communication infrastructure, it's a little bit harder to get information as quickly. Anchorage is, Anchorage is a small city compared to a lot of cities in the United States, but it is the largest city in Alaska, and it is sort of the hub of a lot of activity in Alaska. So Anchorage has a very well-established infrastructure for a lot of things, including communications. Once you move everything up to Nome, it's just a little bit harder to get information and disseminate information and things happen a little bit more slowly in terms of getting the information out towards the end of the race than at the beginning.
How in the world in today's day and age do we expect things to be slower? We expect everything right now on the internet and on Facebook and the media. I can imagine there are people that are just pulling out their hair at 3 o'clock in the morning to find out where that 15th place musher took their last 8 hour rest.
Right. And I've had conversations with people on Twitter and on Facebook where they just say, this is BS. It's clear from the tracker that this musher came into the checkpoint 10 minutes ago, and yet the leaderboard hasn't been updated. And,
right. You
know, we're very spoiled about that. And it's hard sometimes to remember that just 5 or 6 years ago, there were no GPS trackers on the sleds. And the only way that you could have any idea where anybody was to constantly be hitting refresh on the standings page on Iditarod.com.
Right. So we're going to run over by a couple of minutes, Alex, mainly because of some technical issues there. But let's talk briefly about all of the folks in Nome. As the race begins to conclude, we've talked about it many times, and all the fans of Iditarod know that the race is not over when that first person crosses the finish line. We could have almost a week of elapsed time from that first musher to the Red Lantern, and things are just clicking away as if it's the first musher coming in terms of the logistics and all that's going on, and the volunteers as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. And in Nome, there is a big dog yard, and the dogs of the finishing teams are go into the dog yard, and they are fed and cared for. If there are any medical issues, there are vets there who examine them and care for them. And then the dogs are put, usually, unless the musher is from somewhere closer to Nome, the dogs are put in these shipping kennels and put on specially outfitted planes and flown back from Nome to Anchorage. So the dog yard in Nome is a very, very busy place, and there is a certain amount of turnover in terms of the dogs. Once a musher finishes, the dogs are supposed to fly out within a certain amount of time. I think it might be 48 hours or 72 hours. That doesn't always happen for a lot of reasons, including weather and availability of planes and so on. But it's designed so that dogs will be there for a little while and then will fly out. The exception, of course, is the winner's dogs, who are allowed to stay there as long as they like.
Right. So, Alex, I have a question for you that you may have the answer to. I've been to a lot of races, much smaller than Iditarod, and there's always people milling around, in particular the media and fans. On something as big as Iditarod, how do they handle security for this type of thing? I know how it happens in Anchorage, but what about at these checkpoints, and in Nome in particular, how do they keep track of everybody coming and going when you aren't necessarily supposed to be there?
Well, at the start and the restart, they have specific people who are there as security, who will do things like make sure that nobody goes out onto the trail and really keep things in line and make sure that the media are where the media are supposed to be and the fans are where the fans are supposed to be. That is also true in Nome, although to a lesser extent, just because there are probably about 15,000 people at the ceremonial start in Anchorage and maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people at the restart. There are not that many people in Nome generally, at least not when you get past the first or second finisher. And sometimes in Nome, a team will come in and there will be a few dozen to a few hundred people. So that's not as big a concern for it. On the trail, there's a lot of, for want of a better term, self-policing. So the volunteers and the trail volunteers have a very good sense of who is supposed to be where. And if someone is in a place where they are not supposed to be, the volunteers are not shy about asking them who they are and why they are there.
You know, one thing that we have not ever talked about, I don't think, on our show is we've talked a lot about the medical care and the vet services that are available for the dogs, but I don't think we've ever mentioned what happens out there in the middle of nowhere, not necessarily Unicalete or some of these bigger checkpoints, but are there volunteers out there for the people? Are there EMTs or, you know, first responder type folks out there on the trail that help the people if they get sick or injured? And is that something that is a volunteer position as well? Do you know that?
I do know that. There aren't. And there have been several kind of high profile incidents where people have had injuries and have been treated essentially by the veterinarians. You know, if it's something that is very basic, then usually the vets will be able to help out. If it's something more serious, then people would have to be medevaced out of there. But there aren't specifically doctors who follow the race, and luckily so far there hasn't been a real need for that. In some of the villages there are doctors or nurses, and certainly in the larger larger towns like Unalakleet, there are medical professionals. The one other thing I wanted to mention before we run out of time is people have asked in the past, well, where do these volunteers go? Like, where do they sleep when they are out in the middle of nowhere? And the answer is, in villages where there are schools, they tend to sleep on the floor in gymnasiums, sometimes in churches, in areas where there's a large church that has a room where they can put up a lot of people. And in some of the smaller, you know, some of the smaller checkpoints where there is no full-time population, they will basically sleep in tents.
Right. And you talked about that attitude and how everybody's happy out on the trail. I can imagine how people can get a little bit cranky by sleeping on the floor for a couple of weeks, especially if they've never been involved in anything like that. As we mentioned, folks come from all over the world. And all of a sudden they find out they're going to sleep on the floor in a sleeping bag in a gymnasium with 40 or 50 other people when it's 25 or 30 degrees below zero outside. I think that that camaraderie really has something going for it, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, when you're in conditions like that, it goes such a long way if you are with people who know that that's what they're getting into, as all of the people who go up the trail do, and most of whom have done this before and who know little tips and little tricks that can make things more pleasant or more bearable when you are there in the middle of nowhere. And for, as you mentioned before, for a lot of people, this is their vacation. This is their adventure, their chance to go to a place where, you know, most of their friends have never been to anything like that. And most of their friends could not imagine sleeping on a gymnasium floor when it's 30 degrees below zero. And yet there's a certain, I don't know, there's a certain romantic appeal to doing something like that, because it's just so far out of the ordinary and so far removed from what most people's daily lives are.
And if we could close, Alex, with this one point, and I'd hope to get your comment as well. We mentioned it briefly, but all of the volunteers have to pay their way up and their way back. And in some places, Anchorage and Nome in particular, they have to pay for their own lodging. So not only is the expense of travel quite expensive to get to Alaska, for most places it's about I don't know, at least a $700 round trip, depending on when you buy your tickets. But you also have to have a heck of a lot of gear. And this is not the type of clothing that you can buy at the local sporting goods store in Los Angeles. This is very technical gear that needs to hold up to the conditions that in Alaska. So this is not a poor man's adventure, is it? It costs quite a bit to do this type of volunteering, doesn't it?
It can. There also are, once people get to Anchorage, there generally are people who are long-term volunteers who have rooms in their houses or rooms in their apartments, which they will make available for people coming in from out of town. So that certainly helps a little bit. But as you said, this is not something you wake up, you know, the last week in February and suddenly say, hey, I'm going to go up to Alaska and volunteer for the Iditarod. Because it is far away for most people, and because it is requires a certain amount of gear and a certain tolerance for cold and tolerance for primitive conditions, it's mostly self-selecting. And the people who would not think of going on vacation where they couldn't lie out on a beach and drink drinks with little umbrellas in it are just going to be so turned off from the very idea that they will never come up. So to a certain extent, the people who come up and volunteer are the people who really want to be a part of this. And because the trail volunteers are all people who have volunteered before, that's another level of self-selection.
So when you came up, Alex, to do your film and to watch those Iditarod starts, being from Los Angeles, where did you find your gear? And can you tell us a little bit about that? Where you got it? What did you buy? How much did that stuff cost back in those days? You know, give us an idea of what an outsider that is coming up to Alaska to these conditions found for themselves before they came up.
Well, you know, I was not sleeping out in the 30 degrees below zero. So I was able to get by with, just basic gear, a very good warm parka, really good thermal underwear. And, I think it was maybe a few hundred dollars worth of stuff. When I go out on the trail, that's going to require a lot more specific gear and a lot more gear that is really aimed for people being out for hours and hours at a time in 40 and 50 and 60 degrees below zero. And that is when it starts getting expensive.
Well, Alex, we are out of time. Thank you very much for joining us. Do you have an idea of a topic for our next show, or should we leave people on edge a little bit?
Let's leave people on edge. I know we had talked about a bunch of topics for upcoming shows, and I'm not sure exactly which one it will be. But I would urge people to, as always, contact us on Facebook, on Twitter, and we always love hearing your thoughts and your ideas and what you guys would like to hear as well.
Very good. Alex Stein calling in from Southern California. He is the co-host of our show. He also is the writer, director, and producer of Mush the Movie. I imagine that movie is still available. If you're interested, contact him over on Twitter. @ColdFootFilms is his Twitter handle. I'm sure he can make a copy available. Until next time, we'll see you guys later. Goodbye.